You have to solve the problem. A patent that doesn't solve the problem in creating the competitive advantage is a boat anchor. It's a vanity patent. What I see now is that this lack of sensitivity for invention and the rights granted in the Constitution by the powers is not appreciated.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, your host. Welcome to Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the role of intellectual property rights in how creators become entrepreneurs. Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for Intellectual Property Understanding. CIPU provides outreach to improve IP literacy, promote freedom of ideas, and deter theft. Today's podcast looks at how award-winning inventor and entrepreneur Dan Brown succeeded against knockoffs from America's largest retail chain. Understanding IP Matters spoke with Dan Brown from his office at the Siegel Design Institute.
I grew up in a blue-collar family, and you know, I could take a car apart and put it together out of necessity type thing. And you had to develop this ability to solve the problem and fix things yourself.
Dan Brown is a man on a mission. He has earned more than 40 U.S. patents and 11 international design awards. Brown's Bionic Wrench has sold more than 3 million units and generated over $60 million in sales. But success did not come easily. His time-saving tool was sold to Sears until the retail giant decided to save money by hiring a company in China to knock off the hit product. Brown is not only an inventor, he is a designer, an educator on the faculty of Northwestern University, and a founder of Loggerhead Tools. Brown is a first-generation American and the first in his family to graduate from college. Brown believes that America is losing its innovation edge. What are you first, Dan, a problem solver or an inventor?
Well, I think invention starts with creative problem solving, finding a new way to solve that problem, an improvement, something that's more advantaged than maybe solving it in the same old way. That mindset leads you to invention.
How do you go about finding a problem worthy of your interest and that's worth addressing?
In certain instances, like when I was working out of college, those problems were there because I was confronting actual situations that hadn't been done before.
Is patenting always the goal when you're working on a solution?
Yeah, that's interesting. It depends on the role you're playing. You have to solve the problem. A patent that doesn't solve the problem in creating the competitive advantage is a boat anchor. It's a vanity patent. Mm-hmm. So you have to have that novelty, I believe, that inventive novelty to get an advantage and be able to preserve it with a patent. But the overall focus should always be solving the problem in the most elegant way.
Do you fear that the patent, which publishes after 18 months and is, you know, available to others to see, is that a problem as opposed to, say, a trade secret?
If you could keep something a trade secret, it's certainly a very good way of protecting your intellectual property. But many, many patents are easily reverse engineered. So mm-hmm. trade secrets are not an option. It really depends on the context, or if you could have both. Say you had a process that you can get a patent on and also keep it secret. That would itself also be a very, very strong level
right.
of protection. So right. I think you have to look at intellectual property from its own origins and what it's intended to do. A trade secret is one thing, but patents require that full disclosure for you to get that protection in the marketplace that gives you, you know, the ability to stop others from practicing your art.
Your early invention successes were for businesses you worked for as an employee, and as such, you didn't own those patents and those solutions. When did you decide to go out on your own and become a problem solver for hire?
As you noted, I was fairly successful, right place, right time, with the right mindset to create this new technology, and a few pieces of it scaled. My career and business grew with it. And in doing that, it was, you know, great for me to gain that experience as a young person, the management, the leadership, the mm-hmm. things that are associated with it. You know, I got to the point in my career running businesses that, you know, I was leaving on a Sunday, coming home on a Friday, and my kids were young, and I wasn't around, and that created a lot of stress in my family life. And so I figure that if I could do this and have this success that I had in the marketplace, that I could open my own shop as a consultant and continue to do that, but have a little more control out of my personal life so I can coach the wrestling team and the football team and all that, which I did for years and really enjoyed, and spend that time with my kids.
How do the challenges of an entrepreneur slash creator differ from those of an employee?
I was really fortunate. I had established myself as sort of the go-to person in these particular technology areas, and it was not that challenging for me to sell my services. Mm-hmm. Though it was came later, and we'll discuss later when I got to the Bionic Wrench, it was that desire to get outside my comfortable domain and into other product areas that drove me to create some of the other products I've created.
How did you learn about intellectual property? Did you have a background in it? Did you take a course, or you just learn through trial and error?
The pursuit of knowledge for me is really an important thing. Early on, as I was doing the work, I knew that I had to start understanding the intellectual property rights, because I didn't want to develop something that was in somebody else's flower garden, so to speak. And I wanted to find opportunities to get outside that. So that requires research. And I think I am a bit of a natural researcher. So I would use the patents as a form of researching that existing knowledge base to give me a strategic position to sort of design to and definitely know what to avoid.
Talking about the Bionic Wrench, your Bionic Wrench has generated $60 million in international sales, won a slew of awards, but you licensed it to Sears.
We didn't license it. We manufactured it with a contract manufacturer. We sold it to Sears.
And then they paid a company, a Chinese company, I believe, to counterfeit it. How did that happen? How did you solve it?
Yeah. Yeah. So the Bionic Wrench has been in the market now since 2006. We've had about 15, 16 years of sales on that. And it was hard start in the beginning, but I was committed to make that product in the States. And I never bought or drank the Kool-Aid that, you know, we can be a service economy and let someone else do the manufacturing. What I did was that I not only was pioneering a new product, but pioneering a new product in the face of some stiff competition from most all those products being brought in from China. So what that created was a larger hill for me to climb, which was fine, to prove that I could sell an American-made product in that category at the price point, and everybody can win. The people on the line that we followed environmental laws, and we followed you know human rights, civil rights, property rights. We were doing it the right way. Everybody says you got to bring it to China. You have to bring it to China, and it wasn't that I was surprised by that, but I was just not going to do it. And what happened with Sears was it was crazy. I mean, after all this hard work and all this investment, and here they are coming to us, hitting to us at the same old story, you know, you need to go to China. Even after we proved that we could be profitable, it was the most profitable product for them in the category. And so it just did not make any sense.
How was it resolved? What was the final, was there a court decision or a settlement?
We had to see the product in the market. And we, right. You know, it was a funny story. There was a gentleman on the East Coast, and I got an email from him. He said, "Hey, congrats on the, you know, becoming getting the Sears as a Craftsman tool." And I thought, "What are you talking about?" So I emailed him back. I said, "We're not in Sears as a Craftsman tool." He said, "I just was at Sears. I saw the Bionic Wrench in the, you know, as a Sears product. And what had happened is that store had actually put out their inventory for Christmas." Early, maybe a week early, they had it, and the knockoff was there. So then, you know, I asked him to buy some for me, and I reimbursed him, and he sent them. And that's when we saw it. I was suspicious something was coming because they went radio silent on us, and they were still actually selling some of our product. But, you know, we saw the knockoff. That started me searching for a legal team to go after them, to get them to stop.
And how was the case resolved? A settlement, or was there a monetary award? Or
We won willful infringement against both Sears and Apex Tools. Wow. The bottom line was, you know, we won it. We thought, you know, this is fantastic. If you look at, it was a $6 million award, could have been $7 million when they added interest into it. And, you know, with potential willfulness, you could have treble damage, so that'd be three times. So that's $21 million. And we had two defendants. So we didn't know how that's going to play out. It was up to the judge at that time for her to, you know, decide what the damages would be. And we were just waiting and waiting. And then finally, just before Christmas in 2017, she put a ruling out, basically not allowing the damage award, that she felt, maybe there was a problem in the trial. It's just a crazy thing to read. But the reality is she didn't take away our victory. She sort of did a Solomon thing. And what I would say is split the baby in half and, did not validate the jury award. So we didn't get the money. If we wanted to go on with her, we would have to do another trial, which is unbelievably expensive. The trial over the years to that point was around $3 million. It's just, you know, there's no justice in the justice system.
So what's the takeaway for inventors, young inventors and entrepreneurs? What's the takeaway from this? What did you learn? What can they learn from it?
I've seen the winds change from being pro-inventor and supporting inventors to almost being aggressive against inventors, particularly small inventors, that the system is now really a David and Goliath battle that is stacked against the small inventor. I know I'm biased because I'm a small inventor, but I work with big companies and I watched this efficient infringement or this predatory infringement happen many times. I've been involved in a lot of cases where my technology was knocked off through the company that I was working for. And what I see now is that this lack of sensitivity for invention and the rights granted in the Constitution by the powers is not appreciated, and that there's this the level of thinking that doesn't really appreciate when a product is created, that it can goes out and it wins, that is a demonstrated competitive advantage, and that needs to be protected. Mm-hmm. The next level, the takeaway is, who's going to, in their right mind, get a patent and bring something out in the States when they know, one, they could get knocked off so easily from anybody just going to China, and then have a chance of losing their patent now in the district court. Mm-hmm. And a third takeaway is, since our case in 2011, the American Invents Act came out, and that act created a court, well, I don't know if it's court, it's within the patent office, the patent trial and appeal board, where people can go and have your patent re-examined, and you could lose your claims or even your whole patent without even having due process in your day in court. Different system.
Dan, is this because there are too many patents, or the patents are written too broadly, perhaps? Is this reaction to, unless it's a very specific and very high quality patent, it may not be a patent or patentable?
You know, I have 40 U.S. utility patents, probably 10 design patents, and multiple iterations of those throughout the world. I don't believe patents are any lower quality than they were from what I've seen 40 years ago. What I see is that now, because of lobbying and these changes by creating the PTAB, that they're looking at patents differently. I believe that the standard of obviousness, even today, for getting a patent is not the same standard of obviousness that they're using when they're taking the patent away. It doesn't make any sense when you have this schizophrenic type behavior out of the patent office. One side's giving patents and the other's taking them away. How can you reconcile that? That doesn't make sense. And so the standards, I believe, are changed. And it's because standards are based on core precedents, et cetera, that what was considered an invention years ago, now people who are not inventors and probably not even nowhere near the subject matter experts you find in the examining corps are using a process called hindsight reconstruction bias. And an example would be if I showed you a product that was cool and you say, oh, I wish I thought of it. That is so cool. That's simple. Until I showed it to you and disclosed it to you, you had no knowledge of it. Right. You probably would have never created it. That ability to then go back and say, well, that's not so, that would have been obvious for somebody skilled in the art. Well, my position is examiners are people skilled in the art. And my experience has been, though they're new examiners and more experienced examiners, that they're pretty strong advocates for invention and not giving up patents away that are poor quality patents. They play, in my, what I've experienced, devil advocate as they go through the your case, and they go back and forth with you to see what's patentable and what's not. It's not just a simple registration process, which used to be the way, say, in other countries, that there is a threshold to getting a patent. Now, we always presumed a patent was valid originally, but now that's questioning about, you know, is a patent a right or is it a government franchise based on a court case? And, you know, there's a lot of theoretical discussion going on. And while we're going through this churning and taking patents away at a very high rate, Rome is burning.
So you would argue the America is losing its innovation edge.
Well, I think we have to stop the gamification of what's going on out there. We have to stop this predatory infringement, because who's going to, in their right mind, going to make the investments and do what I did? We have two stages here. One, just to get an invention, but then to bring that product out in the States to create the jobs and the tax base that we're looking for. Every election cycle, we have every politician crying for more innovation. So my definition of design is how humans seek, conceive, and create new knowledge. That's on the road to patents. And innovation is how that new knowledge competes with the existing solution, how my wrench competed with the previous wrenches, et cetera, et cetera. And the metric of innovation is competitive advantage. And we are not going to be pursuing this competitive advantage if you can't sustain it and preserve it in the marketplace. It's not cheap. And when you go to scale it or commercialize it, it takes a lot of investment and risk. What we're doing is we have this cannibalistic system that we're saying, oh, we want this innovation. But as soon as something, which it's very rare that something actually comes out that competes that well, comes out, well, these predators swoop in and copy it, and they have a great chance of winning in court, and the inventor is left high and dry.
So what's a small business or an independent inventor to do in the face of this?
The risk is phenomenal. It is phenomenal. I know what they're, I'm a professor. I see people coming out with patents all the time. I have a hard time trying to give them a clear path other than saying, I'd say, be prepared to have to defend your patent in court. You know, you have to put that into your ask for money or whatever from your investors, and that you're going to have to be able to fight that. And then when I say, you know, try to make this in the States, that's the right thing to do. And then they look at what the cost is to make it in China and the States, and the actual target you put on yourself by being an American inventor, American made product, you know, they look at me like I'm crazy. And I guess in a sense they probably should.
A product, Dan, you recently developed with your son, Dan Jr., and manufactured domestically here in St. Louis, called the InstaShield. It sold 1 million units. Then you donated another 1 million units to first responders and medical workers. How were you able to do this and turn a profit?
My son is very entrepreneurial himself. When the PPE shortage started, you know, he just said, listen, we got to find a way to make PPE. Now, there was not enough masks. There were not enough shields. And we were looking at the problem. And he was, you know, really into that. At the same time, being a professor at Northwestern, and I'm in the director of our build things and have rapid prototyping, you know, we were getting panic calls from the hospital and different medical workers, and that we need this PPE. Can you build it for us? We can't do it at scale. This rapid prototyping, you know, machines can't compete with molding, injection molding and assembly. So my son and I, you know, got together on this problem. We said, you know, what can we do? Well, what people basically needed was a sneeze and cough shield. You know, there's no way you could build the tooling, injection mold, and get it there quickly. We're talking about getting stuff in weeks and a month based on the trajectory of this virus. And how do you do that? So I in my design thinking, it's about reframing the problem and looking at it. I realized that you just need the shield. All that headgear and everything else was important if you had an independent piece, but everybody has a baseball cap. Why don't I use a baseball cap that's comfortable and create a shield that will attach to the bill of a baseball cap. Shields hadn't been made that way before, so I had to combine my design and the ability for it to be stamped and make a shield that will adapt to the many different types of baseball caps and then marry it to that manufacturing technology. And my son and I did it, and we did it quickly. And then we created a system that could scale like a franchise, because these manufacturers are everywhere. If we had to make 100 million of these, we could have done it very quickly.
So when did these hit the market, Dan?
They hit the market around June. So would have hit the market
June
a little earlier.
June 2020.
Yeah, but we couldn't get raw materials. As you remember, the raw material shortage for shields and things, we were competing against all the existing technologies of shields that were pulling out of that marketplace. So he had to cough up a lot of money and commit to purchase a lot of material in order to get us going even at that pace. But the way this was a real right now problem. I tell students, when you can get in a real right now problem, that's fantastic, because people are very motivated to change their behavior to do things. We went through the whole commercialization of it. Then Dan took off and developed a marketing and a fulfillment plan that just got it out there. And a doctor who has a fancy face shield may want to wear the fancy face shield. But when you think about food service workers that are wearing hair nets and caps and gloves, you know, you can put a shield on the cap. And, you know, if you're going to have someone at a food service, you don't want them breathing or coughing on your food. It's a perfect use for that type of a design.
Did you always think about giving away a like number of units, or did that come later? How did that happen?
I have to give credit to my son for that. As we were looking at how to position this, you know, we had a number of things. One, for us, he had to commit a tremendous amount of money to the volume. So we had to move a lot of volume. We also had the situation, and it's sort of an ethical or moral thing, you know, making money in a situation, you know, we did not want to be looked at as being some group taking advantage of this situation, you know, where there's shortages and people are raising prices and stuff. So there's a bit of a strategy called cause marketing that Dan came up with, and that we will create, in order to create awareness and build our volume, we'll sell one and give one in this startup in order to get things moving along. That gave us the ability to have a higher production rate, to consume that material that was purchased, and it was the right thing to do. So we worked very hard to get our costs down and work in the supply chain, and it worked. I mean, it was a big risk, but Dan's strategy did work, and I'm very proud of him for it.
Looking back over your many design awards and over a dozen, I believe, and quite very significant success for any inventor, what do you know now that you wish you would have known then?
I made a lot of mistakes and had a lot of, I learned a lot by hard knocks. And, you know, having now been through practice and had the success, and then done a thesis of researching that practice and explaining how it took place, I wish I had those insights, like a problem of bringing a focus to the root of the problem, getting to that, what I call a knowledge gap, where the existing solutions falling short, you know, the problem finding, stakeholder finding, need finding, that there's a much more productive and effective way to approach this designing into these, what I call white spaces.
Understanding IP Matters has been speaking with Dan Brown, inventor, educator, and entrepreneur. To learn more about Brown and his inventions, visit loggerheadtools.com. Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for Intellectual Property Understanding and its supporters. Visit CIPU at understandingip.org. Follow us on Twitter at Center for IP. This episode was produced and edited by Nathan Tower. Content conveyed by Understanding IP Matters is for informational purposes and does not reflect the views of CIPU or its affiliates.